Good morning, everyone. I'm going to call the meeting to order unofficially. We don't have a quorum quite yet, but Representative Haley is treating us this morning. So she has distributed her treats. It is not policy in this bill, Representative, or this committee, Representative Haley, that you treat, but we'll take it as a very gracious response to all the great people you have in the audience today. So, members, if you would look over the minutes, we should have a quorum very shortly. We have today some very important bills. The meeting is called officially. And as I was saying, members, we have some very important bills today. We have Representative Haley's Education Partnerships to lead us off. That will be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance because it has dollars attached to it. Then we have Representative Gernhagen's Special Education Cost-Benefit Analysis Bill. That will be held over for possible inclusion. Representative Kreisha's bill to renew annual food service management contracts on an annual basis. That bill also will be held over. And then we have Representative Kreisha's School Disciplinary Actions Modified. That also will be laid over. And if we have time, we'll get to the chair's legally for the commissioner bill. So welcome, everyone. And we'll lead off with approval of the minutes. Representative Jessup approves the minutes of February 14th. You have looked them over, correct, Representative Jessup?
I looked them over. And I recommend that we move them.
Thank you. Representative Jessup does move the minutes from February 14. Any corrections or additions? Hearing none, seeing none. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. And the minutes from February 14th, which was Valentine's Day, are approved. Welcome, Representative Haley, to your committee. Our committee, and if you would move House File 374 to be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance.
Thank you, Chair Erickson. I appreciate the opportunity to present House File 734 this morning to the Education Policy Committee. And first, I would like to move the A1 amendment,
yes,
if I may.
Representative Haley, to get your bill in order, members. This is House File 734, and we have before us the A1 amendment. Representative Haley moves the A1 amendment. Will you explain your amendment?
Yes, the amendment is to call out that these are public-private partnerships, and we'd like to have it in the bill that includes a certain amount of private funding as well. We are working with our Senate companions on another amendment that this will probably get revised as the bill moves forward.
Is there any discussion on the A1 amendment? Hearing none, seeing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye. Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and the A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Haley, please explain your provision.
Thank you, Chair and members. The Education Partnerships Coalition is a group of six collective impact organizations across Minnesota. The members include the St. Paul Promise Neighborhood, Every Hand Joined in Red Wing, the Northfield Achievement Zone, or Northside Achievement Zone, excuse me, in Minneapolis, Northfield Promise, Austin Aspires, and the Partner for Student Success in St. Cloud. The coalition came together around one very important and significant goal for the state of Minnesota, and that is to close the achievement, what I also call the opportunity gap. By bringing together rural and urban communities to learn from each other and develop best practices, this coalition runs locally focused and very data-driven initiatives to lift not only students but also their parents out of poverty and to help them thrive and ultimately join our state's workforce. This bill is very important to me because I had the opportunity to serve as the director of collective impact strategies at Every Hand Joined in Red Wing. I've seen how this work engages the entire community and truly improves the lives of children. There's three things I'd like you to remember as you listen to the testimony today. First of all, these aren't programs. These are proven, research-based, long-term initiatives that involve multiple community partners and many, many volunteers and parents. Everybody working together to make sure that the education process from pre-K all the way to career readiness is done to the best of our ability. In Red Wing, for Every Hand Joined, the initiative that I helped research, develop, and launch. We have hundreds of volunteers working all year round to help our kids. Number two, these are truly public-private partnerships, and that's why I wanted the amendment added. We all realize schools can't do it alone anymore, and these initiatives truly bring the parents and all community partners to the table. The third important thing is that this gets all the, what I call all the oars rowing in the same direction to move students forward. Things like early numeracy kits out in the community and given to parents. Summer kindergarten boot camps for kids that aren't quite yet ready to spend a couple weeks in kindergarten during the summer learning the ropes. Reading research. Food on weekends for kids that leave school on Friday and aren't sure if they're going to have a meal before Monday morning. Adults coming in to help fill out FAFSA forms for kids that may be first-generation college applicants. All those types of things that the schools need community support on in order to accomplish. I could talk about this all day long, but I'll turn it over to the folks that do the work in the communities, and you'll hear some fabulous stories. Thank you for the opportunity to present the bill.
Thank you, Representative Haley. And our first testifier is Jennifer Lawhead.
That's right.
Please introduce yourself, say your name for the record, and begin.
Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Lawhead, and I am the Executive Director of Austin Aspires. This is a community-driven initiative to improve the quality of life in Austin that began by asking an important question: what kind of community do we want to be? Through a rigorous process of community identified 10 assets that we wanted to move from good to great. Austin Aspires was formed in 2014 through the vision that Austin can be a leader in education with a culture of educational excellence, birth to career, that is embraced in every aspect of our community. As we've started working toward this vision, we looked to the data. A four-year graduation rate is 76% compared to the statewide average of 82%. Our math and reading proficiency scores are below the state average. We also know that 56% of students receive free and reduced lunch. 17% of students receive special education services, and 29% speak a primary language other than English. In our schools, students speak over 50 different languages. Finally, we spent time interviewing over 1,000 members of our community asking three questions. What are the educational assets in our community? What barriers do our learners face? And if you could dream your biggest dream for students in our community, what could we do to support our students from birth to career? Based on these data sets, our leadership table, comprised of leaders from Hormel Foods, Mayo Clinic, the Hormel Foundation, local schools, government, and philanthropic institutions, we identified five aspirational goals for Austin to realize our vision of academic excellence. After these goals were determined, we sought experts from our community to serve on action teams to move these goals from theory to action. Teams selected measures and strategies to achieve our goals based on a rigorous continuous improvement model. In addition to our action teams, we have created a student advisory board with high school students from Austin and Pacelli High Schools who advise our board of directors, action teams, and leadership table in their work. Students were recruited from all corners of our high schools. We wanted representation from students for whom school is working and also for those students who have struggled in school. Through focus groups, personal invitations, and support from teachers and administration, we were able to gather students from AVID and REACH programs. The AVID program, which stands for Advancement Via Individual Determination, prepares students for success in high school, college, and career, especially students traditionally underrepresented in higher education. REACH, which stands for Relationships, Education, Accountability, Character, and Hard Work, is a program to support academic, social, and or emotional support to high school students. We also recruited students from our Alternative Learning Center and from Student Council, as well as the student body at large, to meet with our staff during the school day to offer feedback regarding their educational experiences and needs in the community. One example of the advising they provided us relates specifically to our goal that states, our community will provide equal access to opportunities which encourage our learners to explore areas of personal interest and prepare for post-secondary education or career. Members of our student advisory board indicated that they craved opportunities for short-term job shadowing experiences in potential areas of interest. While our community offers some internship and mentorship opportunities for students, these were often prohibitive due to their length and lack of room in student schedules. Students indicated that before making a semester or summer-long commitment to an internship experience, they wanted to experience careers through a short-term opportunity. To address this, we're offering a short-term event on March 8th for sophomores from Austin and Pacelli High Schools hosted by local businesses. Students will be able to shadow employees in their work and learn about their educational background, career paths, and future opportunities. We look forward to learning from our students and businesses after this experience to expand the program in 2017-2018. Thank you for the opportunity to share information about the creation of Austin Aspires and the work of Collective Impact in our community.
Thank you, Ms. Lawhead, for that very specific testimony. And members, we do have a booklet at our places, Educational Partnership Coalition, and in it you can find the Austin Aspires program. Next, I think we have Zach Pruitt, who's director of Northfield Promise, and Ray Andrade Flores, former Northfield Promise student.
Great.
You're
Thanks
both so there. Much. So I may have mispronounced names, so you'll correct me when you say your name. But you probably want to begin, Mr. Pruitt, correct?
Great. Thank you
Please
so much.
Say your name for the record to sure. begin.
Chair and members of the committee, my name is Zach Pruitt, and I'm the director of Northfield Promise. Northfield began this collective impact work a decade ago as a result of some concerning data that existed in our community. When we looked at the data, we saw that only 1 in 3 Latino children in Northfield was graduating from high school. Among kids on free and reduced lunch, the results were not much better. Only 38% of our students were graduating from high school in 4 years. As a community, we were alarmed by this data. We recognized that schools play a vital role in addressing this, but we also knew that the schools couldn't do it alone. So we designed a collaborative community-owned initiative called Torch to leverage resources to increase the graduation rates for our most vulnerable youth, providing academic support, college exploration, career counseling, volunteer opportunities, and leadership positions. Through this collective impact work, the 4-year high school graduation rates for Latino youth in Northfield have climbed over the past decade from 27% to 83%. For low-income youth in Northfield, the graduation rates in that time have increased from 38% to 87%. Through your legislative support, we are building on this success, serving more youth, and addressing additional gaps that we see in our communities in areas like kindergarten readiness and third grade literacy. I'm really honored today to be joined by Ray Andrade Flores, a Northfield High School graduate, who can tell you a little bit more about his involvement with the Torch Initiative.
Thank you very much, Mr. Pruitt, and welcome. Please say your name for the record, Mr. Flores.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ray Andrade Flores. I am an alumnus of the Northfield High School and of the Northfield Torch Program. I would like to take a moment to tell you a little bit about myself and how Torch and HCI have impacted my life. I first arrived to Minnesota at the age of 7 years old when my parents made the decision to leave Mexico in search of a better life and more opportunities. My parents always wanted my siblings and me to do well in school, and they wanted us to have a better life than they did. However, due to the lack of opportunities in Mexico, neither of them were able to pursue a higher education. They had to work physically demanding jobs, many times earning barely above minimum wage. Since they didn't go to college, it was difficult for them to know how to support us as we pursued our education. As you know, the college application process can be daunting. It can seem insurmountable when English is your second language and you come from a low socioeconomic background. However, I was determined to go to college as I saw education as an opportunity to better my life and achieve my dream of becoming an engineer. I started high school in Northfield and quickly realized I wasn't as academically prepared as my peers. My grades were very low. Fortunately, my freshman year, I heard a presentation from an organization called Torch. Torch is a phenomenal organization that has raised the Hispanic high school graduation rate from 27% to over 83% since its inception in 2005. I saw in them a resource to help me excel academically and achieve my goal of attending college. They provided tutoring when I struggled with homework. They challenged me both inside and outside the classroom. And they helped me achieve my goal of attending college by providing ACT prep classes and college visits. When it came time to apply for college, I relied heavily on the help of Torch. They provided everything from help completing application forms to finding scholarships I could apply for, as well as providing transportation to college visits. I was fortunate to earn a full scholarship to study engineering at the University of St. Thomas. In addition to working on my degree in mechanical engineering, I made the most of my time at St. Thomas. I became very involved I attended over 5 engineering conferences around the nation, including one at Facebook's headquarters in Silicon Valley. I conducted mathematical research and presented at a national research symposium in Washington, D.C. And I had 2 engineering internships at Emerson and Great Batch Medical. 8 months ago, I graduated with a degree in mechanical engineering from the University of St. Thomas. I am now the first in my family to graduate college. And I'm currently a manufacturing engineer at Boston Scientific, creating medical devices. And I'm also pursuing my master's degree in engineering. I am very grateful of all the help and support that I received along the way. I can honestly say that if it were not for the amazing people and support at Torch and HCI, I would not have achieved all that I have. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that compelling testimony, and congratulations on your great successes. Next, we have Sandra Samuels, President and CEO of the Northside Achievement Zone, and Kiana Jones, also from the Achievement Zone. She's a parent. So welcome, Ms. Samuels. Good to see you again.
Thank you, Madam.
Just say your name for the record and begin.
Yes, Sandra Hollinger Samuels. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. So great to be here and with one of our star parents. I want to acknowledge really quickly the other Northsiders and staff members from the Northside Achievement Zone. If you guys could wave. So excited when we get from the Northside and get to the people's house. And so thank you. I want to be really quick because I want to allow our parent to talk about the work of the Northside Achievement Zone. But what I will tell you is that we started this work about 8 years ago without funding. And 40 organizations, including 9 schools, that came together and said, we are the adults of the community, and we have to change our outcomes for our children. I'm sure you all know that the north side of Minneapolis has some of the worst outcomes for children and families, and we were committed to changing that. 5 years ago, we received a $27 million grant from the Obama administration, 1 of 5 throughout the nation, because they know that Minnesota rocks. And to scale up our work, that's what we've been doing. The grant ended in December, but what our outcomes show is that the model that we have put together works, and we are in the phase of now really running this race car down the track to change outcomes for our children. We have 1,000 families, 2,300 children, 0 to 18. What we are showing, and I'm going to send you updated data because we just got our data back, and it's very, very exciting, that the difference between children on the north side who are in the Northside Achievement Zone, getting the wraparound support of our 40 partners, which is results-driven, data-driven, and we're tracking everything together. What it's finding is that there is a significant difference in children not in NAS and children who are enrolled in NAS, who have a family coach, whose parents have the support that they need, who have the coaches who are in schools and in our early learning centers, really wrapping around the children and the parents around career, housing, and health, early childhood, after school, K through 12, and colleges. And I really look forward to showing you that data for both kindergarten readiness, absolutely significantly different, as well as third through fifth grade reading scores. In the schools, we have 3 of our 8 schools, actually, where we're seeing a significant reading as well as math, but reading is incredibly strong, difference between the kids who are in those schools who have a family achievement coach, whose parents are in our circled network of support, and the kids who are not. And so we know that it works, and we're going to keep doing this as a collaborative because we want to change the outcomes for our children, not just in North Minneapolis, but across the whole state. And in closing, I want to say with me is Kiana Jones, and Kiana is one of our 1,000 parents, and she is absolutely leading this work. You know, Thomas Friedman in his latest book, Thomas Friedman, native Minnesotan, in his latest book, Thank You for Being Late, talked about really the greatness of Minnesota. But he said to see that, you really needed to stand on your hands, on your head, because the greatness was really from the bottom up. And so right now, Kiana Jones.
Welcome, Ms. Jones, and we are always delighted to have parents come here. Like, we love students. We love parents, too, because you give us the real meat of what's going on. Welcome. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Kiana Jones. I have 3 scholars, Jemiah, 18, Michaela, 14, and Ayana, 12. And honestly, Jemiah's at Mankato. We didn't have a clue
All I knew is she wanted to go to college. I didn't go to college, so it was a fear. How are we going to come up with the money? What's life going to be like on campus? I can't. She was calling me, freaking out. She has a scholarship. She has a couple scholarships, but there's one scholarship where she has to volunteer with children. So I called my connector, and I said, she can't fulfill these hours because she doesn't have transportation at Mankato. He goes, oh, that's simple. Just go to Family Student Services. I'm like, yeah, and I know that. And I was asked a question. They said, well, then, Dee, how do you feel about your other two younger scholars? I said, I know they're going to graduate, just like I know that Jemiah's going to graduate in 2020 because I have the support of NAS. When I don't know, I go to NAS, and then they go to her. I said, well, do this, and she ignores me. So I called my connector, and I said, hey, I need her to such and such such. I can't get her to go. But NAS is making it possible because they're helping my next generation beyond. Once my daughter graduates and she becomes a wife and a mother, her children are going to go to college. It just doesn't stop with her. Her sisters are going to go to college. And it's going to keep going and keep going. And I know in my heart that they're going to come back and they're going to get back to North Minneapolis, whether it's teaching, social services. I believe she wants to be a dentist this week. That might change next week. But I don't, honestly, NAS even helped her get a scholarship. This, her first year out of pocket, we had to come up with $3,400. And that was with the support of NAS, on the Page scholarship, a scholarship she received from school. Because not only I believed in her, somebody else believed in her. Somebody else supported her. Because I can tell her all day long, don't do this, don't do this. But calling her, connector, and saying, I need you to tell her don't do this. That's important. And I appreciate NAS. And without NAS, I lost my job, and NAS helped me get back on my feet. They were there to even support me when I was down and feeling like, oh, I went to him. He said, oh, you're fine. You can do this. We got you. That's big. I didn't have anybody to turn to say, you can do this. You've been doing it. I hear it all the time. You're doing a great job. You're breaking cycles. Think about it. Three girls, an 18-year-old, no children. I have this reinforcement from NAS saying, Keanu, you're doing a good job. Your kids are doing a good job. When she wanted to stay home because she missed me when she came home from Christmas break, we had to drive to Walmart. And I said, well, fill out your application. Because unless you go back, that's where you're going to be working. No disrespect to Walmart. But NAS made it possible for my daughter to go to college because, oh, the FAFSA is no joke. I was going to pull out my little hair I have, and I once again depended on my connector. And he patiently sat there with me, and we got through the FAFSA. That was big. Because I was going to break every computer. I was like, this is, and then I get this message, you can pay. I'm like, pay, I have no money to pay you to help me get through this. But I don't know. I'm so nervous. I think I messed up.
Well, thank you very much, Ms. Brooks. And I do want to recognize others who are in the audience. If you would just stand, those of you who came to support these programs. Yes, those in the front row, too, if you testify. Very good. Members, we have about 6 minutes that we could spend in discussion. Thank you, Ms. Samuels. If you have questions, we're on a very tight schedule today, as you know. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have to say thank you to the Austin Aspires program for the work that you're doing there. It's a lot different than I went to high school. Just, I don't think we had any other languages than English and German, maybe, in that time, but I really appreciate the work that you're doing. My parents are still there and part of the community, and I know that they feel your presence. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. Are there other comments or questions from members? Representative Bly, yes, you have Northfield to brag about.
I wanted to thank Zach Pruitt and the graduate for coming up and talking about the great work that you're doing. And as I've worked with you in the past and know how important Northfield Promise is. So thank you so much for coming up today.
Representative Haley, closing comments.
I'd like to recognize Charlie Nelson, who is the executive director of Every Hand Join in Red Wing. We don't have time for all of the partnerships to speak, but Charlie's here today. Thanks for the opportunity again to present this bill, and I can't say it any better than the folks that already testified the impact that this is making on kids all over the state, and I'd appreciate your support in moving this bill forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Haley. The chair renews Representative Haley's motion that House File 734, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to Education Finance. Thank you, Representative Haley, and thank you for the treats. Very nice of you. And members, it would be good if you kept this brochure that we were given, because it is very informative, and it supports the good work that these community folks are doing to help their children achieve. And that's exactly what we're looking for, ways to move forward. With that, members, we're going to move to House File 998, Representative Goonhagen. Thank you, everyone who came to visit us today and to lend support.
This is the last healthy one, Chair Erdahl, but I know you don't live that. Okay, you just help yourself.
Representative Christensen, would you be so kind as to move House File 998?
Madam Chair, I move House File 998.
Representative Christensen moves House File 998 to be before the committee. And you have an amendment as well, Representative Goonhagen. So, Representative Christensen, would you also move the A1 amendment?
Madam Chair, I move the A1 amendment to House File 998.
So, Representative Goonhagen, why don't you introduce yourself? We'll act on this momentarily. Say your name for the record and briefly explain your amendment.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members, for giving the opportunity to present the bill. I'm State Rep Glenn Grunhagen, and the bill addresses a 2013 Office of Legislative Auditor report regarding special ed requirements in the state of Minnesota that exceed the federal guideline.
And what does your amendment do?
Oh, the amendment simply addresses the, or adds the word statute as well as Minnesota rules.
I think what it does is it adds "and Minnesota rules" after the word statutes on line 9, members, on page 1, so that this would also be a report that would identify the requirements in both statute and rule. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say to adopt the A1 amendment, say aye. Aye. Those opposed, nay. The A1 amendment is adopted. Now, Representative Grunhagen, proceed to explain your bill.
Okay. What the bill is in response to is a 2013 Office of Legislative Auditor report regarding the special ed requirements in Minnesota over and above what the federal requirements are. I'll just quote a little bit from the report. It says, to the extent the legislature considers Minnesota's special education requirement, it should direct the Minnesota Department of Education to initiate a detailed independent analysis of the economic and educational impacts of any proposed changes. Such analysis are necessary to quantify and understand cost or time savings as well as educational and economic impacts on students. I would just like to add that I have a nephew who's a special needs child. I also have a cousin who's a special needs child, and I don't want to do any type of harm to their educational opportunities. I also served on the school board for 16 years at Clinkle Silver Lake and was involved with several special ed situations. It's a critical area that we need to do the best that we possibly can, but I do believe that based on the OLA's report, which I gave you, you should have a copy of in your packet, that we do need to take a look at analyzing both the effectiveness and cost and to make sure that we're doing the very best we can for students. With that, I'd like to introduce my testifier, Ms. Hauer, from the OLA report.
Welcome to our committee, Ms. Hauer, and please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jody Hauer. I'm with the Office of the Legislative Auditor. Madam Chair, if I might, I have two handouts to be distributed.
Certainly. Pages will take those from you and distribute.
Madam Chair, as Representative Gruenhagen suggested, we released a report back in 2013 on the special education in Minnesota. One of our charges with this evaluation was to look at the extent to which the state of Minnesota had legal requirements that exceeded the requirements on special education that were at the federal level. The two handouts that I'm passing out today, one is what Representative Gruenhagen has already referred to, which is that one of the recommendations in the report, and I'll get to that in just a moment. The second is an appendix from the report, which lists by statute and by Minnesota administrative rule the extent to which the state does, or at least did back in 2013. I realize some things have changed since then, but the extent to which the state's legal requirements did exceed those at the federal level. And just in sum, what we found is that out of the 45 statutes that we examined, 19 contained at least one provision that did exceed the federal requirement, and if you look at that as a subdivision by subdivision basis, over 75 different subdivisions within state law exceeded some provision of the federal requirement. And then when we looked at Minnesota rules, we saw that about three quarters of the 57 rules that we examined did have some provision, again, that exceeded the federal requirement for special education. And if you look at that as a part in the rule or a subpart in the rule, that's over 100 different parts or subparts that exceeded what was in place back in 2013 at the federal level. So with that, Madam Chair, the one point that I would make is that one of our recommendations that's key to this topic is that when the legislature considers changes to the special education requirements, that it look at having analyses of both the costs of those provisions as well as the educational impacts of those provisions. Because what we found is that although there's a lot of discussion around the state about whether this particular provision is useful, whether it's too costly to a school district, we saw a lack of evidence-based analyses that could help legislators understand what the actual impacts were, both on the side of the school districts that have to implement the requirements, as well as on the side of the students, who, of course, are the intended beneficiaries of those requirements. So our recommendation focuses on having, to the extent that the legislature is considering changes to these legal requirements, having analyses conducted that would help you understand more both of those types of impacts, the fiscal impacts on the school districts, as well as the educational impacts on the students. With that, Madam Chair, I conclude my remarks. I can go into more detail if there are any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Hauer. Do we have any questions for the Office of the Legislative Auditor, Representative Erdahl?
Not
a question for Ms. Hauer. Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair. I worked in special ed. I also worked in alternative education. And one of the things that's always, this is a very complicated issue and very difficult to grasp. One of the concerns I have about the proposal is beginning to look at the costs because that may lead us down a path where we maybe aren't going to meet needs. And I'm concerned about that. But I support and would want to make sure that we are looking at what's effective and what will help students ultimately. And earlier we heard a couple of bills dealing with what could be called the misplacement of some students in special education because of the ignorance about cultural differences. And there was a study done that, as president of the Minnesota Association of Alternative Programs, I encouraged, that looked at the comparison of students who were in alternative programs who were special ed, as opposed to people in traditional programs who were in special education. And students in alternative programs did far better. And I think part of the reason that is that in those programs, we weren't always focused on deficiencies. And I think one of the hardest things in helping kids who have disabilities and deficiencies is when you focus on that almost turns them off. And it's harder for them to really get engaged in learning. And in alternative programs, we're trying to search for successes and trying to find ways to encourage them to pursue learning and get excited about learning. I don't mean this as a criticism about special education and the great work that special education teachers do. I think it's important to look at these comparisons. But I think what concerns me about looking at costs is that it may cost something to actually improve our special education system. And if we think that we're going to save money by redoing our special education system and that should be our goal, that concerns me. And maybe that's not what you're implying, but that concerns me. Could you respond to that?
Ms. Howard? Madam Chair and members and Representative Bly, I think that your conclusion somewhat misinterprets our intent. What we found in our research, because we spoke with a number of parents groups, advocacy groups, as well as school district officials, a lot of them have the same hopes and expectations for special education children, but there was disagreement about what was needed to get to that end goal. And what we saw was a lot of dissension without the kinds of analyses that would help make some informed decisions about what is the right path to take. So that's what we came down, not expecting that this would necessarily result in lower costs to the system, but that you could at least, you meaning legislators, could at least have information to know if this change were to be implemented, this is the likely cost, and these are the likely outcomes on the students who would be affected. So it could go either way. I could see those kinds of analyses saying this is going to represent a higher cost, but the benefits to the children are X, Y, and Z. And then our expectation was that with that kind of information, you're in a better spot as policymakers to decide what is the correct route to take.
Representative Bly, follow-up?
No.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Howard. That was really, I think, a good explanation of what the report was trying to get at. And I know you did a very thorough one. Representative Ward, you have a question for our guest.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just skimming through this and thinking about all of the things that have just been said. Would it be more appropriate at this time than to have a study? What is effective? Because it sounds like we don't know. We have a lot of questions and not a lot of answers as to what really is effective and what strategies and techniques are really effective, even in diagnosing and attributing, as Representative Bly said, when we are assigning children to special ed when they are not necessarily appropriately assigned there. Should we be evaluating that whole system with a study before we take some action in terms of, especially in terms of cutting funding?
Ms. Howard, did you want to try that one?
Madam Chair, Representative, our focus was on the extent to which the requirements in place here in Minnesota exceeded those at the federal level. And so the kind of evaluation you're speaking of may well be deserved, but that wasn't really our focus. Our focus was trying to compare, which was our task. We were charged with looking at where, to what extent do we exceed here in Minnesota the requirements set at the federal level. And that's where we saw a lot of dissension between people who wanted to maintain or perhaps even increase the set of requirements that are here in Minnesota and others who were saying that there are some unknowns about those sets of requirements, and as well as some costs attached to those requirements. So I just think that your idea may well have good merit, our focus was a bit more limited than that. It was thinking about only the extent to which the requirements we have in place here exceed the federal requirements.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Howard, for clarifying. Representative Boyd, follow-up?
Yes, please. Just very quickly, it sounds like what we've learned what we needed to learn from Viola's report, but it sounds like we've raised more questions, and I would hope that we could find those answers or seek those out. I have received a lot of emails from parents who are very concerned. There's a fear that their children's services are going to be cut because of this. So I think we need to be really clear about our communications about this.
Yes, thank you, Representative Ward. And in no way are we going to diminish what our special education, special needs children have coming in our present system. I think Representative Gruenhagen is looking for exactly what the OLA report recommended, and that was to analyze the benefits and the costs. And as Representative Bly suggested, it may cost us more. But, you know, if the federal government would just come up with their up to 40%, I think it would cost the state far less. Probably $500 million would be the extent of what we'd have to spend if we had that support. Thank you, Ms. Howard, very much. We're going to move to those who are concerned. So would parents who have joined us or others? Representative Erdahl, you have a question for Ms. Howard? Yes. We'll get to that. Can we hear from our – thank you very much, and thank you, auditors from the OLA who may have attended. So we have concerns, and we welcome you. I believe this is Mr. McNeil.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Please say your name for the record and begin.
My name's Don McNeil. I am a father and a lawyer by day, but father 24/7 with my wife. We have three children, Megan with Williams syndrome, Evan, who is in the grad program at the university trying to get into med school, and Ethan, who is still in school, who has classic autism, the autism in which he doesn't speak and has challenging behaviors. I'm here to speak in opposition to this bill. You should also know that I am a board member of the Pacer Center, and I'm here as part of the Pacer Center, which is part of the Coalition for Children with Disabilities. I also, you should know, served on the committee in 2008 and 2009 at the request of this body to study the extent that our state laws and regulations exceed the federal minimums. I also co-chaired in 2013 and 14 at the request of the Department of Education the OLA's last round on this particular issue. And in that report, both of those times, we provided to this body reports that we think help improve and give you some innovative ideas. In 2014, we gave you 29 specific ideas that we thought would be useful. I'll tell you that what we viewed this bill as losing focus on those ideas that we brought to you. We spent countless hours, mine pro bono, that my law firm noticed, working to come up with these ideas for you. Now, in those committee meetings, they were full of people that were from administration. There were parents there. There were teachers, educators there that all brought in different ideas on how to improve our system for special education in Minnesota. We think this bill loses focus. And I'll note two areas, since I think we've already done our job looking at different ideas. What this bill asks you to do is quantify economic issues and then also educational benefits. So if you look at one of the two ideas, in Minnesota we ask our teachers to look for short-term outcomes for our students so we can measure how we're doing in progress. How do you quantify that? You can say, well, there's some nominal amount of review during an IEP meeting, the individualized education planning meeting with the parents, to plan out what you're going to do over the next few months. Well, how do you quantify that a limited amount of time since you're going to be at the meeting anyhow, but then how do you figure out what was the impact on the education for the child? We're all trying to get to the full potential, but if you start looking at how you're going to using the accounting principle on my child and how he has done in progressing, I don't know how you're going to quantify the progress that he's made in reaching his full potential. You're instead making him into dollars and cents in this bill. The second one, this was important to stakeholders because we thought we were doing better than what the federal told us to do. And that's exactly what we like. We often complain that the federal government in D.C. is telling us what to do. Well, here we are in Minnesota using some common sense. In the transition program, the stakeholders want to transition to graduation to be started in ninth grade rather than arbitrarily at age 16. We think we're doing it better here in Minnesota. How do you quantify that in dollars and cents? This bill asks somebody to spend taxpayer money to go back and study this issue and come up with some dollars and cents, but I don't see how you quantify the difference between age 16 versus ninth grade. What's the difference going to be? There are many, many more examples. I'll give you one more personal one. I'm a lawyer by day. I know that our conciliation system that we put together in Minnesota to help resolve disputes between parents and administration on how to educate the child works. It works better than anywhere else in the country. And I think if you look at the litigation numbers, that our system shows that we do not spend anywhere near as much money on attorney fees as other states do. That is another prime example why I think we're losing focus of this bill and looking at issues that we don't need to. We should go back and stay on focus on what our task force have provided to this body. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Aberholden? Please say your name for the record and begin.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Sue Aberholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. I've actually worked on special education issues since 1981, so I've just aged myself there. But I've been working on this for a very long time. This issue has been studied a lot. I would have brought all of my records and files on this particular issue of where we exceed federal, except I would have needed a wheelbarrow. We have looked at it that much. We have, from 2008, the Bureau of Mediation Services that went through a huge, long task force. I have documents after documents that has the comparison and where advocates fell and where, the schools and the School Board Association went. We absolutely know what the differences are. This is not just a cost issue, but it's really a political issue, right? So anytime when you have groups that don't agree on certain things, that's the issue, is that you have to get them to come together and figure out what to do. I will say that back in 2009, we had this report, the Bureau of Mediation Services, mm-hmm. and several of us were put in the very top of this building in a very, very hot room, and we came together and actually came up with some things that we could all live with. The transition issue, we used to start at age 14, and we all agreed, okay, we'll just look at high school instead. That makes more sense. You have more of those kind of career counselors. We looked at due process issues, where federal exceeded, or we exceeded federal, and came up with some agreements about what we could do. We looked at suspension issues as well. So we looked at a whole range of issues. When you look at even at the OLA report, I can tell you exactly which ones cost money. A big one is that we serve children beginning at birth, which I actually helped pass back in the 1980s, because we believe that when a child has a disability, you want to help them right away. You don't want to wait until they're age 3. That's probably the largest cost right there of where we exceed federal. We passed legislation in 2009 restricting the use of seclusion restraints in Minnesota. Great progress by the schools and everyone else. Well, we exceed federal there, but that was an issue that we decided in Minnesota, that children shouldn't be treated that way, and we need to have protections for them. So, you know, I think if you really want to do this again, I don't think you need to do a cost-benefit analysis. I think you put a bunch of us in a hot room again, to really think, are there other ways that we can move forward? Go back and look at those other recommendations. But I'm a taxpayer as well. I care about how we spend our money. This isn't going to get you there. If you really want to look at where we exceed federal and where we can change it, then you need to put the people in the room who disagree and try to figure out where you can get an agreement. Having this additional information isn't going to change the political views about how people view special education. So, again, thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Pepperholden. The department, I believe, would like to make a comment.
Welcome. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Caitlin Snyder from the Minnesota Department of Education. I'm the Deputy Director of Government Relations. This is my first time testifying in front of this committee. That doesn't necessarily mean you have to be nice to me, but if that is your instinct, then please follow it. I'd like to thank Representative Grunhagen, who allowed me to touch base with him this morning about two areas of concern that the department has with the bill. And the two areas can be summed up, frankly, by the words time and money. First off, this is an RFP of this size and scope could likely take 4 months before we have a vendor under contract. So assuming funds are available July 1st, the first month or two would be spent internally writing an RFP. We would need to have a month to have the RFP posted and receive responses, and then 4 to 6 weeks to evaluate and negotiate with the selected vendor. So this would take us to mid-November, and at this point, none of the analysis required by the report has been begun. The second concern related to funding, we believe that this will be a significant amount of work for whatever the selected vendor is. As Ms. Hauer mentioned, there are 100 statutes and rules where Minnesota either in whole or in part exceeds federal requirements. So each of those statutes or rules above the federal requirements would have to be analyzed from an economic basis, from a time basis, from a staff basis, and from an educational benefit basis. We think that this could be enough work for multiple people to do over a year. And, of course, that would result in a significant cost for this report as well. And with that, I will yield to any questions.
Thank you very much. That was very well explained. And, you know, a lot of these bills that we hear, committee, are so we can learn. And there was an OLA report, and some work has been done. We've made changes legislatively. And so I thought this would be a good opportunity for us to learn a little bit more by hearing this bill. We will be laying it over. And I think there was a question for Representative Erdahl. You have a question for Representative Grunhagen. Thank you, Ms. Snyder, very much. You did a very good job.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a comment and a question. First of all, this is obviously a concern that's been out there for a long time. You know, I've certainly been aware of the greater number of provisions and requirements the federal government has than we have more than the federal government. And also that the fact is, Chair Erickson was saying, the federal government is supposed to spend 40%, and I believe they've never exceeded 17%. And so, you know, I actually commend you, Representative Grunhagen, for bringing this forward. And I, too, I'm sure we all have received many email of people expressing concerns about this, feeling that this is the first step in, you know, dismantling some of our special education programs. And I'll just ask Representative Grunhagen, is that your intent with this?
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative Erdahl. No, my intent is what the OLA report says, is to make sure we're spending the money as effectively as possible and to also make sure that we're using the best possible educational approaches and techniques with the special ed students. I have a nephew and another close cousin that are both special needs, seriously so. You know, I understand it's difficult to quantify some of these areas, but I think with the number of statutes and rules we have, I think there are areas that we can be, and according to the OLA report, which I have a lot of respect for their office, they believe it is a necessary step in making sure that we're doing the most effective job we can for our special needs students and also spending the money in a way that is most effective for them.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Grunhagen. And, I would concur with you. I fail to see why it's wrong to compare and analyze our special education programs with what the federal government has required. So hopefully this will be a fruitful endeavor.
Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To some degree, I think my question was answered it's saying to do a comprehensive report that really gets to important data seems like it would cost. a fair amount of money to do something like that. And I don't see any fiscal note costs associated with the legislation.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. Representative Grunhagen, closing comments.
Yes, I want to thank you, Madam Chair, and the members. I think this is a critical area in our educational system. It deals with some of our most needy students, and we don't want to hurt them in any way possible, but I think based on the OLA report, we should evaluate where possible what we're doing. I am getting some additional input from other organizations as to what to prioritize in the study and hopefully narrow it a little bit and address some of the concerns the Minnesota Department of Education has. Thank you again.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. And with that said, Representative Christensen renews his motion that House File 998, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Thank you, members. That was a very thoughtful discussion. Representative Kreisha, House File 652, School Food Service Contracts, members. And be sure that you read through that appendix that the OLA left us, if you're interested, members, because most of you were not here when this was issued, and it is very interesting just for us to learn. Representative Kreisha, welcome to our committee, and Representative Jessup moves House File 652. For possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Is that correct? Representative Kreisha, please say your name for the record and explain.
Representative Kreisha.
And go ahead and explain your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And before I do that, I just have a slight technical correction. Actually, it's an oral amendment I'd like to offer on line 3.1. Where it says may be renewed annually after its initial term for not more than, and cross out three and put in four. The intent was four additional years, and I'd just like to ask the committee if I could have that oral amendment.
Representative Jessup moves a technical change to line 3.1, changing, deleting three and inserting four. Is there any discussion, members? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye. Those opposed, nay. The technical amendment is adopted. And I guess we didn't really have to vote on a technical amendment, but it's official now. Proceed, Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And I have with me one testifier, Tina Burkholder, who I'm going to turn this over very quickly to. But this legislation proposes to allow school districts to renew annual food service management contracts up to four additional years. Essentially what happens is if you like your contract, we'd like to reduce going out to the bidding all the time and just allow that to go on. The federal law allows school district food service contracts to be for 1 year initially with a maximum of 4 1-year renewals, but Minnesota law limits contracts to a shorter time period. This bill proposes to allow school districts to align to the federal requirements. With that, I'll turn it over to my testifier, Ms. Burkholder.
Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Tina Burkholder. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the last 4 years, I've been the business manager at Monticello Public Schools. We are one of the schools in Minnesota where we contract out our food service program. I was the controller at Buffalo Hanover Montrose for over 8 years, and we had our food service program housed internally, so I've experienced both situations. Currently, like you mentioned, the school districts can renew their food service contracts annually after the first contract, but for no more than 2 years. We're asking to change the requirement where school districts could renew at least every 4 years to align with federal law. School administration understands the value of the process. This helps the district obtain competitive prices as well as competitive services. Before I was hired at Monticello, the school district was with the food service company for over 18 years. Food service employees were getting injured on the job, work safety was a concern, and was rated high on our next round of proposals. The existing company didn't address this concern in their proposal. Another company did, so we switched. We have had great success with our employee safety in the kitchens for the last 6 years, not to mention having a successful meal program. There are different variations of contracting out food service programs. At Monticello, we contract out the food service manager and purchasing of the food, but the cooks in our kitchen are Monticello employees. My neighboring district in Big Lake recently changed to contracting out their food service program. But for them, their food service manager and their kitchen staff are both contracted employees. Typically, the kitchen staff will more likely live in the community they serve. Changing to a 4 years would provide more stability to the program and is helpful for the kitchen staff to know who they're working for and for a longer period of time. Finally, it is a time-consuming task for administration, who could be doing many proposals at once. For example, right now I'm doing the food service proposal for the last couple weeks when I can fit it in, our health insurance proposal, a property insurance proposal, and possibly a dental, life, and long-term disability proposal. It's not uncommon for districts to do an auditing service proposal or a banking service proposal. We like to do proposals. It's not only time-consuming for school administration, but it is time-consuming for the staff at the Minnesota Department of Education. They have to renew our proposal before we can send it out, plus they review the contract before we sign them. At the end of the day, school districts can still choose not to renew at any time. There's still an option to make a change if things aren't working out. In Monticello's case, we may not have opted out of the contract early, but we did make a change. We were not afraid to do so. Every year is not an automatic to renew for us. We have a year-end meeting with our food service manager and their supervisor where we talk about our expectations, how did the year go, what are our concerns, and what are the expectations for next year. They know they work for us and our students, and we will not settle for anything less. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Burkholder, and thank you to business managers who I know have a huge responsibility, and as you said, considering proposals and signing contracts. I'm wondering if the department or the school boards association wants to make a comment on this proposal. If not, members, are there any questions? Representative Jessup, the mover of the bill.
Chair. Representative Krusher, and yes, I just want to say I am fully, fully in support of this effort. The amount of time and effort that goes into renewal contracts when a school board and a vendor are doing well just is so much hassle. So I just want to go on record. I am fully in support of this effort. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Jessup. Closing comments, Representative Krishaw.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It's a great bill.
So the chair renews the Representative Jessup's motion that House File 652, as technically amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Krishaw. You're not going anyplace, though.
I am not, Madam Chair. I'm here all week.
Members, we move to House File 905. Our bill of the day, I believe this is going to be. And members, we will be laying this bill over. So we have now until 10 o'clock, unless we want to come back tonight after house session. So I think we can accomplish this. The chair will move Representative Krisha's 905 to be before the committee. I don't believe there will be an amendment later when we get to amendments. Representative Y has one, but we'll deal with that after we've had an explanation of the bill. Representative Krisha, please reintroduce yourself and explain 905.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so if you've heard as much about this bill as I have, I've heard from both sides. And I want to be very, very clear about what the intention I have in bringing this bill forward. I'm just looking for a conversation. We have conversations all the time. What we have is a committee process. I'm going to tell you I actually don't know which way I am on the language of this. But what I do know is we need to bring groups to the table to have the conversation so that one group doesn't feel like the language that's being introduced is being pushed at them or shoved at them unfairly. So what I'm doing with this bill is, and I'm sure we're going to have lots of testimony, we're going to have, I'm hoping, not a lot of passion and anger on either side. What I'm hoping we can do is have the conversation so we can get to a respectful place and come back with a compromise that actually solves this problem. Because the reality is you're going to hear from both sides that have very, very strong and legitimate arguments, and let's hear those, and let's see if we can do what we're supposed to do down here, which is come up with good policy. So with that,
I'm actually not going to say a lot about it. I'm going to let I'm going to open up the court and let the testifiers make their cases.
And members and those who are testifying, we're going to allow 10 minutes for those who support and then 10 minutes for those who have concerns. So you'll have to make sure that your comments are not repetitive to fit into that time slot. And if we can exceed that a little bit, because we are right on time, according to the schedule we set out, we'll provide for that. So we'll start with those who support. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. It is an honor to appear before you. My name is Michael Waldsberger, and I am an attorney with the law firm of Rupp, Anderson, Squires, and Waldsberger. In fact, I'm one of the founding partners. My firm represents nearly one-half of the public school districts in the state of Minnesota, as well as many charter schools. I've been practicing law since 1994, and more than 20 of those years have been dedicated to the practice of school law in Minnesota and Wisconsin, and I'm testifying in support of a proposed amendment to eliminate the word willful from the Minnesota Pupil Fair Dismissal Act. Expulsions have never been easy decisions. School boards agonize over the right course of action, over balancing the rights of students, all students, and the right to safety and to an education in the interest of a student who's been proposed for expulsion, and I've observed that firsthand. By way of background, the Minnesota Pupil Fair Dismissal Act has three grounds for dismissal. One, willful violation of any reasonable school board regulation, provided that the regulation is clear and definite and notice of the regulation is provided to pupils. Two, willful conduct that significantly disrupts the rights of others to an education or the ability of school personnel to perform their duties or school-sponsored activities. Or three, the third ground is willful conduct that endangers the pupil or other pupils or surrounding persons or property of the school. For more than two decades, the language willful violation or willful conduct, now let's talk about the willful violation of school board regulations first. That was interpreted to mean that a student had received notice of a regulation and then engaged in conduct that violated the regulation. So, for example, if you had a school board regulation that prohibited the possession of illegal drugs at school, and a student was aware of that regulation, was given a copy of it, was reviewed with the child, and the student subsequently was found in possession of marijuana at school, that student would be deemed to have willfully violated that regulation. Similarly, with respect to the ground for dismissal for willful conduct that significantly disrupts the rights of others to an education, that meant that the student willingly or knowingly engaged in conduct, and it had that effect of disrupting the rights of others to an education. As many of you know, on August 3 of 2016, the Minnesota Supreme Court issued a decision in the matter of expulsion of AD from United South Central Schools. The court held that the Pupil Fair Dismissal Act requires a school district to show not only that the student knew of a school policy, but also that the student made a deliberate, intentional decision to violate that policy before the student can be dismissed, meaning suspended, expelled, or excluded. That second requirement is brand new. The facts in the United South Central case are very instructive, and I think you need to know about them. In short, in that case, there is no dispute that the student knew of the district's weapons policy. Also, there's no dispute that there was a knife found in the student's purse in her school locker. However, the student claimed in that case that she had totally forgotten about the knife found in her purse, despite the fact that she brought the same purse to school on the previous day, and despite the fact that she remembered when the school was in the middle of doing a school-wide search, whoops, I have a knife in my purse, and she doesn't tell anybody. The Supreme Court said because she forgot, or she claimed she forgot, there was not willful conduct there, or willful violation of the statute. The court also held that possession of a knife by itself doesn't automatically endanger others in a school environment. Now, what's the practical effect? What I really need, Madam Chair, you and the committee members to know about is that as a result of that decision, in literally every single case involving possession that our office has seen since the United South Central case, the student has asserted, I forgot. It's a very hard defense to overcome. The reality is it doesn't take students long to learn the value of the I forgot defense as soon as they get an attorney to represent them. And if law doesn't change, we're going to certainly see that defense asserted in every case. The other big concern that I have is that school districts are now unwilling to even consider expulsion because the burden of proof is so high, because the playing field is now slanted so far in favor of students, and it adds to the expense of the process as well. In my personal observations in my practice, again, representing roughly half the districts in the state, we have seen roughly a tenfold decrease in the number of expulsions coming forward. This doesn't mean that students aren't engaging in that same serious, concerning, dangerous behavior. It just means that expulsion is not happening. And while on the one hand you might say that's a positive outcome, the reality is we have students who are presenting a risk of harm to others and are still in the school environment. I'd like to just take one moment to debunk a couple of myths that you may hear about. One, you may hear claims that removing the word willful will have an adverse impact on students with disabilities. Such claims are simply untrue. Students with disabilities have significant protections under federal and state law. They cannot be expelled or removed for behavior that's a manifestation of their disability. Plus, they have the right to have their IEP implemented during the period of expulsion. All students, in fact, have a right to receive educational services during a period of expulsion. The same is true for students of color. The law prohibits any kind of discrimination based upon race, color, religion, or other protected class status. And then finally, any kind of parade of horribles that you might hear about is really disproven by the fact that we have 20-plus years of history. In short, statements of fear about removing willful are not based in fact, because removing willful will do nothing more than return the statute to the way it was interpreted for more than two decades before the Supreme Court's decision in United South Central. And with that, I'd like to say thank you and turn the time to other people in support of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Walzberger. We have a few others, so if you have something different to say, please say your name and begin.
My name is Paul Schmitz. I'm the principal at Wilmer Senior High School. Madam Chair, thank you for the ability to talk on this issue. I'm not an expert. I'm bringing my opinion from my small rural district. My district is, I've been in education for 25 years. I've been in an administrative role for 16. During those 16 years, I've overseen programs that I was responsible for the discipline policies in level 3, 1, 2, and 3 emotional and behavior disorder programs, in our alternative learning programs, and now at the Wilmer Senior High School. My district has rising poverty. We're up to 70% in some of the buildings, and we're over 50% in all buildings. In that time, we have dropped the days lost by suspension by 300% in the last 7 years in my building. So equal access to education and due process is a passion of mine. I volunteered to be on the Pupil Fair Dismissal Working Group that was in statute by the legislature and presented at the House at this committee last week. I've been part of spirited conversations. I think there is right for people to be concerned about due process and access of education for students. However, I don't believe that this particular portion of the bill reaches that. I think the use of the term willful will put us in an unknown position, and we can spend all sorts of time talking about potential unknowns. The student brings prescription opioids to school. Do we have to prove that they knew that they were class 2 in order to have a discipline? If they say, I didn't know what they were as they're distributing. I think this will put administrators in litigious situations, and I think there's enough unknowns with where this will go that it concerns me, even though access to education is one of the most important things to me in my career. And the one thing that I will repeat is the exclusion of the word willful will keep us status quo. That now, because of the Supreme Court rule, the new definition of willful, that will put us into the unknown. So I'm asking that you keep it the way that it is and address access to education and due process through measures that you've seen through other bills, especially from the committee that I was a part of. Thank you.
And we have another testifier. Very quickly, if you have something different to say, please introduce yourself and begin.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Greg Coyle. I'm a district principal and district administrator for the Anoka-Hennepin School District. What I will say is two things that we celebrate, and I believe that the other districts in the state of Minnesota celebrate these two things. One is when our families, our students, and our staff report they feel safe in our schools, that their kids feel safe in our schools in the mid-90s, our survey data show recently. We celebrate that. The other thing that we celebrate as much as that is when our suspension or expulsions go down. If they go up, if we have more suspensions, that is a disappointment, that is a failure, that is something that we look at and say that we need to do better at. And so just please know that when we're talking about removing willful, that is not a way that we can find ourselves suspending more kids or expelling more kids, because we would view those things as failures, and I believe that our colleagues in districts all across Minnesota view it the exact same way. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Call. Very quickly, sir, say your name and begin.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Peter Shaw, and I'm the Assistant School District Attorney for the Rosemont-Apple Valley-Eagan School District. That will be very brief. Just like to say that, first and foremost, District 196 wants to keep students in the classroom, and we support alternatives to suspensions and expulsions, and we're very happy that in the last 5 years there's been a downward trend in suspensions and expulsions in District 196. But what we are, what I'm concerned about is the standard placed on school districts to prove a willful violation, as interpreted by the Minnesota Supreme Court. And Mr. Walzberger really explained this well. I'll just emphasize that the standard that the Supreme Court is holding school districts now to prove a willful violation is, in fact, higher than you would see a criminal prosecutor have to prove in a criminal case, where simply the prosecutor would have to show that the person, the defendant, did a bad act, that they intended to do the bad act. Now school districts are held to the higher standard of having to show that the student deliberately made the choice to violate a school policy that they knew about. So I support passage of House File 905. I believe it still obviously keeps substantial due process rights for students, and it adds some for elementary school students. And with that, I'll yield. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Shaw. And I know there are those in the audience who have come. We probably don't have time to hear from you, but if you are a school official, would you please stand so that we know that we have many in the audience who are concerned? Thank you very much for coming. And please don't leave, because when we get to question time, we'll need you to answer questions if they arise. Now we'd like to turn to those with concerns, and you will have a little extra time. You'll have a minute and a half extra, so I think we have John Thompson, Kalia Pringle, Melissa Gallagher. Any of you want to come forward, please, and share with us probably something different from each of you in regard to your opposition to this change. Welcome. Say your name for the record and begin.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Andrea Jepson, and I'm going first because the group of us that are here in opposition to House File 905 have decided that it makes sense to have me come first, because I am the attorney who argued the INRI AD case to the Court of Appeals and the Minnesota Supreme Court. And the INRI AD case involved a student who accidentally brought a small pocket knife that she had been using to bale hay on her on a friend's farm. And in August of 2016, the Supreme Court affirmed the Court of Appeals decision that when the legislature passed the People Fair Dismissal Act in 1974, it intended the word willful to have its plain meaning, which is intentional. So when you're told the Supreme Court created new law or altered practice, it's important for you to know that the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals opened a dictionary and didn't change law, but rather made clear that school districts who were not following that standard already were not following the law. But I didn't need the Supreme Court to tell me that the legislature intended willful to have its plain meaning, because I spoke to Senator Joe O'Neill, who sat on the Senate Education Committee in 1973 and 1974 and heard one of the bills that would ultimately become the Pupil Fair Dismissal Act. And I asked him, Joe, in 1974, did the legislature intend for willful to mean anything other than intentional? And he was emphatic that it did not. But I also knew, understood the legislature's intention because I spent a week at the Minnesota History Center reviewing the legislative history of the Pupil Fair Dismissal Act. And what I learned was that it was an act that was passed in response to significant litigation around the due process rights of children in school, and that it had broad support from school districts, school administrators, teachers, community members, and students, because this students' right legislation, they believed, would stem the flow of litigation. I caution you to, when you hear, I think it is fair to say that school districts want to avoid expelling and suspending their students, but I caution you to look at the data, because expulsions and suspensions are on the rise. For the last year that we have data, that's 2015-2016, our state suspended and expelled 54,000, almost 55,000 students in our state. That information is available on the Department of Education website. The year before that, we expelled and suspended 40,000. The year before that, we expelled or suspended 50,000. Our suspensions and expulsions are on the rise. But the most important thing I can tell you as a lawyer today is, first of all, you should take legal arguments with a grain of salt, because lawyers will disagree about the status of the law and the implications under the law. But what I'm here to tell you is that if the legislature turns the Pupil Fair Dismissal Act into one of these so-called zero-tolerance policies, which is almost universally frowned upon as a best practice by all kinds of national organizations, including the NEA, the National Association of School Social Workers, the National Association of School Psychologists, it will create an unconstitutional statute. And that's a big problem, because people are going to start lining outside of the door at my office and other attorneys bringing suit again. And that's because the Minnesota Constitution created a fundamental right in education for our students. And when you have a fundamental right, you have certain protections provided to you under the state constitution, but also under the U.S. Constitution. And one of those rights is the right to due process. Due process means there are certain kinds of procedures that need to be followed, but due process also means that you have to have notice so that you can order your behavior according to the expectations of a rule. And you can't order your behavior if you can be suspended or expelled for behavior that is inadvertent and accidental. That's what we're talking about here, inadvertent and accidental violations of rules could result in a loss of education. When I was at the Court of Appeals and the Minnesota State Supreme Court, I urged the judges to remember that showing willfulness is not an impossible burden. Mr. Walsberger was not correct in telling you that school districts have a high burden in a school dismissal in case. In fact, the burden is very low. All a school district must show is that it's ever so slightly more likely than not that the student engaged in willful conduct or a willful violation. And that student doesn't have to say, I intended to do it, which has been an argument. Rather, schools are free to look at the totality of the circumstances. Was a kid carrying a knife in their backpack? Well, you don't bring a backpack anywhere other than school. That gives schools a pretty good idea that this is willful. Did a student have a small knife in her purse and a history of working on a farm? Well, then it probably was unintentional. Just ever so slightly more than not. There's a terrific amount of discretion in that. It's very important also for this committee, the legislature at large, and school districts and the community to remember that we're talking about the loss of a child's education. I know that many people will come after me and tell you that suspension and expulsion, well, maybe they won't, let's hope they won't come in and repeat this, is the data show us that that suspension and expulsion are correlated to an increased risk of repeating a grade, an increased risk of not graduating from school, and an increased risk of future contact with the juvenile and criminal justice systems. And there are other ways to correct a child's behavior. Schools are have almost unlimited control over their ability to punish students creatively in ways that instruct and don't exclude and don't interfere with students' education. This is a statute about the circumstances under which a child's education can be taken away. And if this body ultimately takes away the willful standard, we're going to have a very serious constitutional issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jepson. Committee, this is so interesting, isn't it, that we get to hear two sides of a very critical issue. It's just amazing to me that we have this kind of talent out there who can come to us and help us understand these issues. I think, I don't know who we want to hear from next, but will you say your name for the record, I believe?
Melissa Gallagher.
Yes, and please speak.
All right, thank you. I'm here for the student of education reform. I don't agree with this bill. How can a child get an education when they get suspended or dismissed all the time for the littlest things? Teachers need to go into, I feel, an in-service, how to deal with children with ADHD, which my son is. Also, if a teacher has it out for a child, then that child's doomed. Also, what are the consequences on a teacher sexual harassing, bullying, cursing at a student? I just wanted to add, like I said, my son is ADHD. He was dismissed over 100 times for being late, not having a pencil, getting up to go to the bathroom, which a teacher told him not to, and I told him to. Also, he got suspended and dismissed. Also, I have taught my children to earn respect. You need to give respect. And the teachers at Humboldt, including the principal, have always harassed my son. The only teacher that went above and beyond her teaching was this teacher named Teresa Banky. And I feel like, don't pass the HF 905 rule. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Geller. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Hi, my name is Asia, and I'm with Students for Education Reform and also a recent graduate at High School for Recording Art, a charter school. So me growing up into St. Paul and traditional public schools, I've constantly get suspended for willfully defiant, for being late, for not having my pencil, or even for me having a bladder. So it really hurts. And then for people like lawyers or people that have not been around, like, urban, and that's the people who is getting suspended, people of color, Latinos and African American. There's data out there, and then we have people, policymakers, that don't be around or don't even know. And I feel like we should not pass this bill because we already got no tolerance law, and that is really bad, and we're adding more laws to put, you know, like, we have, like, the standards of how a child's supposed to act or how a person's supposed to act when we all know that we are not perfect, especially when we're going through adolescence. So putting these laws in here is because we don't come in on time or because we accidentally brought a knife or whatever the case may be, because of a farmer or whatever the case, because of that fear that you have of our color. And that's what it is, fear. And that's what I'm going to keep saying is that fear. So please do not pass this bill, because we got people from Anoka and suburban areas. Sorry. We got people. No. Yeah, no, I'm sorry. We just got people from different areas that it's not part of the urban area, just like we have teachers coming from suburban areas coming in urban areas that don't. They have their certain way of how they want to have their classroom, and they're constantly suspending kids or suspending them.
Thank you. There's a principal in the audience. Hey, Robin Francis, could we hear from you? Sir, could you just wait until we hear from the principal? Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Welcome to our committee, and please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you. I'm Robin Francis, and I'm currently an interim principal at Sankofa Underground North Academy in North Minneapolis.
Again, I appreciate the opportunity to speak, and I'll be very brief. As a current administrator, I'm more than aware of our current discipline disparities. I'm also aware of the different districts that are currently under both a voluntary and involuntary agreement with the Office of Civil Rights. And the premise for these agreements are more than likely inequitable discipline practice. Taking away due process for students will be a step backwards. We need to be mindful that we're working with children, and they are going to make mistakes. And we need to put equitable practices in place that ensure our students learn and grow. As a leader, all of my decisions are made based on this mantra: what is in the best interest of my babies, my students, my scholars? And I have to ask you this: is this bill truly in the best interest of our scholars?
Thank you, Principal. We have one last testifier here. You know, those who won't get to speak today, we're going to have other bills coming before this committee, I'm sure, very shortly. And you'll be welcomed back to hear other proposals that will come forward. So please don't feel bad that you don't get to speak, but we have to have time for members to ask questions. Welcome, sir. Please say your name for the record and begin.
My name is John Thompson, for the record. I am I work for St. Paul Public Schools. I'm a machinist for the district. I'm quite sure you guys seen me before. My friend Philando Castile was the guy who was tragically murdered in St. Anthony. Me and Philando both work for St. Paul Public Schools. You're probably going to see me again. I don't agree with the bill, and it's simply because I want to bring truth to the matter. It's going to affect African-American kids in the door. We are, African-American kids are the ones who are always suspended at an all-time high rate. And I want to coattail off of what the young lady said. When I come and see these bills, I always see our community underrepresented. Like, there's nobody from St. Paul that's here saying, yes, we support this bill. St. Paul's predominantly African-American kids. You're going to put kids out of school for being kids and take the word willful out. Well, you willfully put them in the streets when they're willfully getting killed for stepping on another man's Jordans. We're talking about the kids 16, 17, 18 years old. Also, if you want to do something, invest some money in parks and recs. You're going to put them out of school. Where are you going to send them? Where are you going to go? All right? This is going to affect African-American children. And let me be clear, it's only going to affect African-American children. I don't see many kids in Apple Valley being suspended. I don't see many kids of my color in Rosemont. But I do see it happening here in St. Paul. You guys have to get it right. And stop coming for our babies. Stop coming for our babies. And that's what this bill is aimed at. Our babies, African-American men, ADHD. Let me just give you a brief rundown about the African-American men. ADHD in the African-American household stands for Ain't No Daddy at Home Syndrome. All right? So let's get to the root of the problem. All right? Stop trying to substitute doing your job. Your job is to educate the kids. Your job is, once you get them in the building, to keep them in the building. Your job is to make sure that graduation is the key and not suspension. That's your job as an educator. We're talking about lawyers. Lawyers are coming here proposing bills, talking about kids bringing knives to school. Kids are being kids in these schools. I also see a large police presence in the schools. You want to stop some of this stuff in the schools? Stop spending all this money with the police department. Stop putting some of these parents in the schools on the payroll. I was terrified when my mother worked at the school. My mother worked at the school. So I was terrified of the butt whipping I was going to get when I got home if I acted up in school. Alright? So, I mean, they already make that a crime to spank your kid at home. Alright? So, I mean, you're taking away all the tools that we use to educate our kids and to discipline our kids, and kicking them out of school is a cop out. We need graduations and not suspensions. We need graduations and not suspensions. I'll say it three times. We need graduations, not suspensions, not expulsions. We need graduations.
Thank you. Thank you. And, you know, everyone, keep in mind that we hear these bills so we can hear from you. And then we'll proceed to debate this. So we appreciate all the comments that you make, whether we agree or disagree with them. We want to hear. We are the people's place, and so we really do appreciate. Members,
Questions for the author? Representative May Quaid.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Crucia, I think there were some good points brought up, and so I'll ask you a question I've asked you before. Did you do an equity impact statement on this bill?
Representative Crucia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I've looked into that. That's done usually in law enforcement, not education.
Representative May Quaid.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's correct. We actually only look at the impacts on racial disparities if we're talking about criminal justice, which I think is awful because there's a lot more things that affect people of color than going to jail. So you asked before all of the people who are here to support this bill. Can you guys raise your hands again? No, to support the bill. You raise your hand. Okay. To support the bill. Okay. You see that? Who doesn't support the bill? This is your equity impact statement right here in the room. You had 15 white guys raise their hands because they're here for this bill. And you have students of color. You have people of color telling you here that students of color get suspended more often. When black students speak differently than their white teachers, it's seen as being uppity, talking back, not being precocious or questioning. This happens every day. We have 96% of our teachers are white teachers, and we have a third of the students in our district, 196, are students of color. So I want you to think about these things. I want you to think about these things before you bring these bills to this committee. Think about the equity impact that we're having, because we have them in more than just criminal justice. We have to do better for our communities, for our state, for the people in this state. We have to have policies that take this into consideration. We don't want to debate that. We don't want to make people come and tell us what the equity impact statement is. Bring bills with that on it, because we keep perpetuating the racial disparities in the state, and we are doing nothing to check and see if the new things that we're proposing are going to help or hurt. So I think we've heard some of that today, but I really would ask you to continue to think about it and bring that here too. Thank you.
And Representative May Quaid, you can prepare a bill. You know that. And I know that there are others out there who are doing likewise. Representative Crucia.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. If I could respond?
Yes, please.
I think if you look at the bills that I've sponsored, I'm right there. You can cast me however you want, but I'm the guy that crosses party lines all the time and is as inconsistent as you can be around here. I've sponsored bills that we need to bring more teachers of color in to match their students. I've sponsored bills. I have a bill right now that I'm listening to the groups in the minority community that are saying, we want choices. We want to get out of our neighborhoods. I've been the biggest advocate in child protection for the kids that are being in the most disadvantaged areas. So you can try to cast me however you want, but look at my record. I didn't bring this bill here, and my initial comments were, I haven't told you who I am yet. What I've said is, they need a seat at the table, and they need a seat at the table. And what I'm asking you to do is to think about the conversation we have to have. You're absolutely right. But don't pin us into a corner when we bring a bill up. Let me give you some other examples. Because I, too, have been a teacher. I've been in the middle of 18 and 16-year-olds fighting. I've been in the middle of those fights. I've had to break those up. I've had to back teachers. I've had to back students. I've been the one that has gone to the school board and said, don't suspend this kid. I've done that. I've also been the track coach for ADH kids that had nowhere else to go, and when they were swearing and using the Effenheimer at teachers because they didn't know any better because their meds had wore off, I was the one defending that kid. And what I'm saying to you today, community members, is let us have this conversation. Bring these two sides to the table and let them have the conversation. What I'm not saying today is make any changes. This bill will be laid over. What I'm saying is these groups have simply asked to have a conversation. Let's let that happen. Let's let the process. And I will give you my word, and my word is everything around here, that if I can't get compromise language from these sides, I will not come back to you with changes for this bill. But don't shut the door on them. Don't cast us as who we may or who you may think we are. I'm just trying to have the conversation. That's an opportunity, and that's all I'm asking for, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Crucia. Representative Bly, you have an amendment to offer. Would you like to offer it?
Just to make some comments.
Please, go ahead. And so I think I'll say then that Representative Bly withdraws his amendment but would like to comment. Please go ahead, Representative Bly.
Thank you. And Representative Crucia, I was very heartened by your opening statement. I think you're absolutely right. This is a conversation that needs to happen. which is also why I feel very comfortable withdrawing the amendment, because I believe that that conversation will take place. The testimony on both sides was very good and informative, and it's great that we've started that conversation. I just want to say two things, I guess, and one is that, and I take these as symptoms of why we're here. And one is that I think it speaks to our lack of understanding of behavior and how to deal with behavior. And that's something we need to confront as educators and as community members. The other thing is that I think this is symptomatic of a wound in our society that needs to be healed, and we need to work together very hard to solve that problem. And whether conscious or unconscious, it's a problem that is voiced by the words, you don't belong here. And we really need to confront that and figure out how we are more inclusive, how we are not turning people away because they're different. And even if that's not necessarily the intent of those who might exclude or suspend students, that is the message that's perceived by other communities. And we need to make sure that we are speaking to that and that we understand how we can heal that wound. It's very important. Thank you.
And Representative Bly, I think those were excellent closing comments. Representative Grisha.
I'm going to leave it at this. And Representative Bly, thank you. I was actually going to add, you're right where I was hoping we could be. Let's have a conversation. And you said something there. You said there's the perception. Let's remove the perception. I'm listening. I'm not hearing. And there's a huge difference. And I think that, I'm sorry I'm born this color. I'm sorry of who I am. But that doesn't mean I won't listen.
Oh, excuse me.
It doesn't mean I won't listen to the conversations and bring us to the table. I'm trying my very best just to get people to talk. And that's all I can do.
Thank you, Representative Krisha. And with that, the chair renews the motion that House File 905 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Members, please take House File 1048 and place it in your folders. Because we'll pick up with that at some later time, but I'd rather not have the pages have to redo it. So if you could place it between today's and the save, that would be great. And members, we have a big week next week. On Tuesday, we will hear the licensure bill that I introduced recently, and I've spoken with Representative Mariani, so he knows which file that you will place your amendments to. So with that, members, this meeting is adjourned, and thank you.